Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility of a full-scale invasion of Gaza by Israel's defense forces in response to rocket attacks from Hamas, as tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have been inflamed by the murders of Israeli teenagers and the grisly revenge killing of a Palestinian boy. Gabriel Peterberg, a professor of Middle East history and author of The Return of Zionism's Myths, Politics, and Scholarship in Israel, joins us to discuss what military force might achieve, given that it has been used on Gaza before without any apparent success. Then we will speak with a former United Nations political officer and election monitor in Afghanistan about the latest contested election with the same candidate who was cheated in the last election, Abdullah Abdullah, claiming victory in last month's election, although preliminary results have his opponent winning by 56.44% to Abdullah's 43.56%. Christine Fair, the author of a new book, Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, joins us to discuss the threat by Abdullah to create a parallel government when NATO is preparing to withdraw from Afghanistan in the face of ramped-up Taliban attacks, with one on Tuesday that killed 16, including four NATO soldiers from the Czech Republic. Then finally, we'll examine why Google, who led the battle to preserve net neutrality and an open internet back in 2006, is now absent from the fight, leaving it up to the smaller tech companies and startups to take on the cable and telecom giants Verizon, AT&T, Time Warner, and Comcast, who want paid prioritization on the net that would allow them to become the gatekeepers and toll booths, speeding up their content while slowing down yours. Julie Samuels, the executive director of Engine Advocacy, a public interest group that supports the growth of technology entrepreneurship, joins us to discuss why Google, Amazon, Facebook, Netflix, Yahoo, and Microsoft can afford bad net neutrality. And joining us now is Gabriel Peterberg. He's a professor of Middle East history at UCLA. He grew up in Israel, served in the Israeli Defense Forces, graduated from Tel Aviv University, and went on to get his doctorate from Oxford University. He researches the history of the Ottoman Empire and also modern themes such as colonialism, Zionism, and Palestinian-Israeli relations. He's the author of An Ottoman Tragedy, History and Historiography at Play, and The Return of Zionism's Myths, Politics, and Scholarship in Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gabriel Peterberg.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to join your program.
And Gabriel, it seems that in both in the case of Netanyahu and Hamas, they seem to be being dragged into this cauldron of strikes and counterstrikes that could lead to another ground invasion. At the moment, the Air Force and the Navy are pounding Israeli Air Force and Navy are pounding Gaza. But it seems like Netanyahu's motivated by the fact that he's sort of, you know, his right-wing parties and his coalition have sort of moved way ahead of him. They seem to be holding the high ground with his foreign minister and Naftali Bennett and others pushing, you know, the envelope. And the same thing seems to be happening on Hamas's side, where even more extreme groups seem to be pushing the envelope. So is that what's happening? Is that the dynamic that's going on here?
Well, let me first of all remind everyone that there is no proof that Hamas was responsible for the kidnapping of the three Israeli youths and their killing. They certainly didn't take responsibility, and it's not clear at whose control and by whose behest this was done. Secondly, every time an event like this erupts, there are questions about what caused the immediate escalation, which I think is the wrong question. I think the narrative of what happened is well known. The basic problem is Israel's reluctance to end the occupation and conclude peace, and the rest are very tragic details, but they are details, and what will happen now is that the magnitude of the atrocities still remains to be seen. In other words, if there will be a land invasion of Gaza, then we will see more of what we saw in the past, which is white phosphorus, bombings, snipers, murders, atrocities, war crimes. And the supposed purpose of eliminating the Hamas infrastructure, which is usually the euphemism for doing these things, will of course not be achieved, and they will not eradicate that organization. What it may lead to in addition is the further erosion of Israel's image, which is already rather low.
So, Gabriel Peterberg, when you point out that there's no evidence that the Hamas was behind the kidnapping and murder of those three Israeli teenage boys, which Netanyahu certainly accused them of, I guess it's pretty unusual for them not to take credit, right? I mean, that's the point.
It is. It is very unusual, and it would not be within their logic to do so. They just had this that reconciliation agreement or national unity with the PLO. It presented a further problem for Israel because most of the world accepted that national unity. And as you say, it's not their pattern not to take responsibility. And it's also not their pattern to kidnap and murder. I'm talking here in pure cold terms, because they want usually to gain something out of it, which is to negotiate the release of prisoners. So kidnapping and murdering seems to be, I stress, seems to be not their pattern either.
So, Gabriel Peterberg, the Israeli Defense Forces say that about 117 rockets have struck Israel since Monday night, with about 29 of them being intercepted by the Iron Dome missile system. And Hamas themselves have said they fired rockets at Haifa, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem. Obviously, they haven't reached those targets, but that doesn't mean they haven't tried. So it doesn't seem like Hamas is sitting on their hands.
No, they're not, and we never know what exactly provoked that response. This occupation, which is the longest in the 20th century, has this strange logic. As long as there's quiet, which means that the Palestinians are sufficiently oppressed and don't do anything to resist the occupation, then everything is fine and nothing is happening. When they try to resist it, then all hell breaks loose, and then all American spokespeople come out and say that Israel has the right to defend itself, as if the occupation itself is not one continuous violent offense.
And indeed, President Obama came out and echoed exactly what you just said. I spoke yesterday with Max Blumenthal, who's written a book about contemporary Israel called Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And he provided a very alarming portrait of a kind of angry right-wing society with a lot of young people gravitating to right-wing politics and demonstrating quite openly and often in the streets, shouting death to Arabs, etc., and that there's virtually no peace movement. There's no of the traditional Israel that, you know, the kibbutz and all of that, that sort of socialist utopia that I guess is a long and faded myth, right, at this point.
Right. Well, the left in Israel is dead, and I don't see it resurging anytime soon. But I have to say that I have been obviously following Palestine, Israel for many, many years. And whenever I think that I know it all and nothing can surprise me, something does. I have not seen in the history of the conflict such an eruption of fascism and racism as I have seen since the kidnapping of these three youngsters. I mean, it's the social networks are full with it. The street is full with it, and the lead is from the government. It can be embodied in a placard I saw one woman carrying in Hebrew in a demonstration, and to translate it from the Hebrew, it says, hating Arabs is not racism, it's values. I mean, I think that in a nutshell is the situation of the society.
Well, apparently on Facebook, a lot of prominent both politicians and other figures in Israel are posting, you know, pretty hateful stuff about exterminating the Arabs, etc. And that's, you know, so when did this, when did it pass that degree of acceptance in Israel society? There doesn't seem any pushback. First of all, in the United States, there's total ignorance, as far as I can tell, in the press about the nature of this resurgent sort of right-wing hate speech in Israel, which is not what you normally associate with, you know, the Israeli democracy.
Well, that's because the main media outlet in the United States are controlled by pro-Israeli elements. But it's been known throughout the world for anyone who wants to see it and know about it, especially with the proliferation of all sorts of sources of information nowadays. When it started is hard to say, because it's a process that with continuous deterioration that really has no bounds. I would say that the visible, there were two signs of this visible deterioration. One was the fascist agitation against Rabin after he signed the Oslo Agreement, which was headed by those who run the government now and their predecessors. And the second was during the Second Intifada, and especially the Turkish flotilla that tried to sail to Gaza. Mm-hmm. But it's an ongoing thing. I mean, the shouts of death to the Arabs and racism against the Arabs and what one is allowed to say deteriorates daily. Newspapers, television, social networks, internet, you name it. You should read the talkbacks that Amira Haas and Gideon Levy in Haaretz get. It's horrific.
Yeah, I spoke to Gideon Levy just the other day. So tell me, Gabriel Peterberg, again, professor of Middle East history at UCLA. He grew up in Israel, served in the Israeli Defense Forces, graduated from Tel Aviv University, and then went on to get his doctorate at Oxford. He researches the history of the Ottoman Empire and also modern themes such as colonialism, Zionism, and Palestinian-Israeli relations, and is the author of An Ottoman Tragedy, History and Historiography at Play, and The Return of Zionism, Myths, Politics and Scholarship in Israel. So obviously your subject matter that you've studied for a long time, Gabriel, that is the Ottoman Empire, was the last time there was any real stability in the Middle East. And now it turns out, of course, what replaced it, the Sykes-Picot artificial borders, are just disintegrating before our eyes. As the chips fall, it seems to me that at the moment, the most vulnerable country is Jordan, which now has very, very dangerous jihadis on both its Syrian and its Iraqi border. And that's always been a tenuous state, 60% Palestinian. What happens if Jordan goes under? My understanding is that the Israeli defense forces or the Israeli government will not allow the Hashemite kingdom to fall. So what will they do if push comes to shove?
Well, they were the long-standing Israeli position on this is that both declared and undeclared is that they will not let Jordan fall into an unwanted regime, and we know from the late 60s, early 70s that they were already ready to prevent that from happening with Syria and the PLO, It's a good question that you raise. I mean, I don't know what will happen if Jordan is under threat and its collapse is imminent. But I do know that the modern Middle East is a concoction of the colonial powers in the wake of the First World War. Except for Egypt, Iran, and Turkey, most of the states are creations of this colonial meddling. And now they are falling like a house of cards, again, because of the intervention also of the United States, of course, which is another imperial power meddling in the region. But if you notice, all the states that were created by the Sykes-Picot Agreement and resolutions following the First World War are the first to crumble. Iraq, Syria, maybe Jordan, although this is a different colonial concoction. Israel, Palestine, which is a different story, but it's also unstable. And Lebanon could follow. So it might be that you're right that the Ottoman Empire was the last stable phase of the Middle East in memory, which lasted for 400 years. And now we don't know what will happen to the Middle East. And if we look at it as a long-term process, it might be that these colonial concoctions are not in tandem with the, so to speak, natural structure of the region and runs against it, and it might be collapsing.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, you know, over the years, it's been Israeli military officials and intelligence officials that have pushed for a peace deal with the Palestinians on national security grounds. So I find it incomprehensible that the Israeli right and Netanyahu and company would, in fact, don't recognize that if they have to get militarily embroiled in Jordan, which will not be popular in the region, they... the fact that they haven't taken care of the Palestinian issue makes Israel incredibly vulnerable. You know, I don't see how you can fight your enemy abroad if you can't come to terms with people within your own borders.
No, I think you're right. And to give you again a historical perspective, which after all, I'm a historian, not a commentator on current affairs or a so-called expert. The situation in Israel-Palestine is the one of a settler-colonial conflict between settlers and indigenous people. I don't know of any case in history in which the settlers allowed indigenous sovereignty unless they collapsed. There was native sovereignty in Algeria and in Kenya and eventually in Rhodesia and South Africa, but all these settler projects collapsed. Successful settler projects have never allowed indigenous sovereignty or claim to indigenous sovereignty. And I don't think this case is different.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Gabriel Peterberg.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gabriel Peterberg, who's a professor of Middle East history at UCLA. He grew up in Israel, served in the Israeli Defense Forces, graduated from Tel Aviv University and went on to get his doctorate from Oxford University. He researches the history of the Ottoman Empire and also modern themes such as colonialism, Zionism, and Palestinian-Israeli relations. He's the author of An Ottoman Tragedy, History and Historiography at Play, and The Return of Zionism, Myths, Politics, and Scholarship in Israel. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the loser, or if indeed he is the loser, in Afghanistan's elections, threatening to form a parallel government. چشمان مست سیاهت مبند نازنی نازداری با موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی بچند. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from India is Chris Fair, who is a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, the Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And you're in India, and of course, Pakistan is a country that you're also specialized in, but you've had some problems with the Pakistan ISI, the intelligence service. Is it?
They do not like my new book called Fighting to the End. In fact, they hate it.
But does that mean you're a person non grata or your life is in danger in Pakistan?
Oh, look, I don't know. These things can change, but like I'm not able to get a visa right now. So I'm actually in India on my book tour. So I've had a couple of presentations down in Mumbai, and then I'll have a few presentations here. So, yeah, right now I can't get a visa for the Pakistanis. I don't really see that changing anytime soon. And if they were to give me a visa, I'm not sure that it would be prudent to go.
So what is happening in Afghanistan? It feels like we're cursed, and so is that nation cursed in a way. The idea that you have elections, and now the losing candidate, Mr. Abdullah, who may well not have lost, is just addressed a big rally in Kabul where people were chanting death to Karzai, long live Abdullah. He's contesting the results, and his supporters are talking about setting up a parallel government. That's a nightmare, isn't it?
So, you know, in some ways this actually plays to Karzai's hand, whether or not he wants to understand this. If this continues to spiral out of control, Karzai can simply declare an emergency. And then this whole process kind of goes into a default. So I think from the point of view of Abdullah, there really were a lot of electoral irregularities. And as you know, I was actually an election observer in the first round of the election. And everyone was pretty enthusiastic about how well that went off, all things considered. And I think there was a little bit of insouciance about how that second round was going to play out. And I think Abdullah, from his point of view, this is the second election that's been stolen from him. I remember in 2009, there was an industrial strength fraud. And remember, he also contested the results in 2009. And it was really only after a lot of international pressure that they persuaded Abdullah to concede defeat. So what the international community is basically doing is asking him to concede defeat twice, when from his point of view, he probably won. And of course, in this particular round of the elections, everyone recognizes the massive fraud that's gone on. So my concern is that what will actually happen is that the situation will degrade to the point where Karzai will simply say, I'm declaring an emergency, and he actually holds on for power. Now, listen, from the Americans' point of view, I'm not so sure that they think this is a bad thing, right? Because I think they're really concerned about continuity as we're trying to withdraw. I'm actually fairly surprised at how freaked out American officials are by the unwinding of the electoral events in Afghanistan.
But it was, after all, Karzai that wouldn't sign off on the U.S. exit or the NATO exit agreement. And the theory then was that he wanted to be able to control the outcome of this election. And so is he going to win one way or the other? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, Karzai either gets the candidate that he wants or he can declare an emergency and he stays on as president. So, I mean, I do think that he is in the position of cutting up the pie and taking whichever half he actually wants. So this is a danger that we run into if Abdullah doesn't concede, and if he mobilizes violence, and if he tries to set up a parallel government, he really is playing very much into Karzai's hand, because Karzai can simply say, I have to declare an emergency, there's nothing else I can do, I'm still the president until there is a new president, and the situation is impossible to actually inaugurate a new president, so I'm just going to hang on to power. And who knows, maybe this was Karzai's design all around. The other thing, which is a very real concern, is what's called Article 61 in Afghanistan's constitution. And that says that if any presidential candidate is killed from the beginning of the election, which I guess starts with registration, up to the time when the new president's actually appointed, the entire election is null and void. So the other possibility where this becomes completely FUBAR, and again, where Karzai remains as president, is if one of the candidates is killed.
Well, that's not entirely unlikely in a strife-torn country. And that, I think, doesn't that get to the heart of the problem, Christine Fair, that even though at this big rally, Abdullah says, we don't want civil war, we don't want a crisis, we want stability, national unity, not division. The country is divided, and the military itself, the army itself, could split up, surely. If there's so many disaffected people that support Abdullah, with roots in the Northern Alliance, isn't that a likely consequence? And furthermore, there have been some pretty brazen Taliban attacks lately, including just today, a bomb near Kabul killed 16 people, including 4 NATO troops. So that's the backdrop, surely.
Well, so my sense on the army, and of course, you know, with Afghanistan, one can never be confident, really, of anything. But my sense with the army is that as long as the money keeps coming, and commanders are being paid, that's a pretty strong incentive for the army to remain unified. Because if they were to break apart, basically factions around Abdullah and Ghani would essentially have to be getting their own money, right? So as long as the international community, read the United States government, continues to pay the recurring costs and so forth of the ANSF, particularly the Afghan army, I don't really see that happening. Where that happens, where that becomes a real risk is if the money stops. Because in some ways, you know, the Afghan National Army is kind of a concatenation of a bunch of militias anyway. And they can basically fall away just as easily as they could be aggregated up. But I don't see that happening in the near term. My real concern is that, let's remember, Pakistan has also a lot of stakes in this election. And they view Abdullah as an Indian proxy. So the Pakistanis don't want Abdullah. And so there's a lot of different options that until this new president is inaugurated, where we kind of go back to zero. Like I said, if the Taliban are successful in assassinating one of the candidates, the whole thing starts all over and Karzai essentially stays on as president. If violence ratchets up and the internal security situation degrades to the point where he can declare emergency, he stays president. So there's a lot of different ways by which Karzai simply wins.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and she's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point, and she joins us from India. But why would the Taliban, for example, want to assassinate Ghani if he is, not that he'd be their preferred candidate, but at least you said Abdullah is somebody that represents their enemy?
Well, I don't necessarily think that Ghani would be the target of the Taliban, but there are a lot of other militias that would be perhaps supportive of Abdullah. So there's people all around that would have an interest in assassinating either of these persons. And in the event of assassination, the remaining candidate doesn't become president, the whole thing starts over. So Afghanistan has to really think about that particular provision in its constitution. And short of an assassination, like I said, the real risk is that if Abdullah keeps... Now, look, you can't blame the guy. From his point of view, this is the second election that's been stolen from him. And the stakes are really high, right? Because whoever becomes Afghanistan gets to basically loot the country for 5 years. So you can't really blame him for being angry and not willing to go out with a fight. But if they go this route, it really does ultimately play into Karzai's hands.
Well, Secretary of State Kerry arrives there on Friday, presumably to try and referee this mess. But when you mentioned Abdullah, this is the second time the election's been stolen from under him. The original election, 5 or 6 years ago, was stolen from under him. And the deputy head of the UN mission there, Peter Galbraith, tried to blow the whistle on that theft. Apparently, Abdullah actually won the first round. He may not have won the second round, but the point is that the election was so rigged, and this allowed, of course, Karzai to loot the country, as you said, for these past few years. Do you see that as a pivotal turning point, that we would be much better off had we stuck with Galbraith's assessment and not folded?
So that's a tough one, because in my view, when I was doing work in Afghanistan, before the 2009 election, remember, President Bush was sort of very much vested in Karzai winning. And we were, as a U.S. government through USAID, we were investing in several government institutions, namely at the time the IDLG, which was this institution that was meant to help appoint people to lower levels of governance, like, for example, provincial governors and so forth. And Karzai was using the IDLG to put into place governors at the provincial level and the district level, and a host of other officials that would essentially give him the infrastructure to win the election. And this was all happening under President Bush. I think what everyone understood, when I was there in 2008, everyone said, look, the IDLG is basically Karzai's reelection mechanism, and of course, USAID was funding it. When Obama won the election, Obama was not very keen on either Musharraf, of course, or Karzai. But in some ways, and I mix this metaphor deliberately, the train had already sailed on the rigging of the election. And so there was ultimately, by the time Obama sort of did the interagency review, all the different reviews that were finally done in the last hours of the Bush administration, it was very difficult to roll back that rigging. And so I think that if we were to go back and were to play that game, it's not clear that what we do know is there was industrial strength rigging. It's not clear that even without the industrial strength rigging, that Karzai would not have won. I mean, I don't feel comfortable saying that Abdullah would have been the winner had it not been for that rigging. So it's hard to say what would have played out to our advantage. And had Abdullah prevailed in that election through a bureaucratic declaration of victory, for example, by invalidating the swaths of illegal votes, the Pakistani commitment to doing things nefarious in Afghanistan may have even intensified. And, we're kind of in the bad place that we're in because we're dependent upon Pakistan, right? And they're completely opposed to just about everything that we want. So I'm not sure how much it serves our purpose to do that would have, could have, should have. But I am very concerned right now, as we're trying to really get the hell out of Dodge, that this transition is so flawed and it's so precarious, and it can so easily play right back into Karzai's hands. That's what concerns me, not so much thinking about what happened in 2009, because I don't think we could have rolled that back.
Well, obviously, there's no point in revisiting the disasters brought upon the United States by the neoconservatives and the Bush administration, but
yes.
After all, it was. But they have come back, I have to admit, on television now, and now they're the anointed opinion makers on what's happening in Iraq, which is pretty surreal. And among them, Zalmay Khalilzad, the former Bush-appointed ambassador to both Afghanistan and Iraq. So,
I'm glad you mentioned Zalmay Khalilzad because, again, we talked about how, and also I'm really glad that you called the nonsense flag on the various media outlets that are bringing the architects of our failure without holding them to account whatsoever. I mean, I'm glad you raised that point. Now, going to the point of Zalmay Khalilzad, we can talk about how corrupt Karzai is, but many elements of that corrupt system Zalmay Khalilzad himself built. So, for example, many of Karzai's closest advisors were being paid two salaries, one by the World Bank Trust Fund and then by the Americans. And this was completely illegal, and this was something that was being done by the embassy under Zalmay Khalilzad. And maybe in the last 4 or 5 months, there was finally some reportage on this. I was really surprised that there wasn't some sort of hearing or investigation, because what was actually being done was incredibly illegal. And so imagine in the earliest part of this war, as early as 2002, your Karzai, and actually I know this for a fact, the email that was sent describing the secondary source of income, and of course the email from a USAID official said, please don't print this email out. The person did print the email out, and one of Karzai's loyal staff members picked up and gave it to him. So how would you feel if you were Karzai and you knew that your closest advisors were surreptitiously on the American payroll? So we tend to blame the Obama administration for losing Afghanistan because Karzai and Obama famously despised each other. But I would argue that everything that we did, from the way in which we fought the war to whether or not we even had to have fought the war, frankly, really, all of this does go back to the Bush administration. And some things are so broke beyond repair that you just kind of have to consider them sunk costs and figure out a way of moving on. I think that's where we are with Afghanistan. It's just not something that we can fix at a price point that we can afford. And also, I might add, at a price in terms of human loss that we are willing to continue paying.
Well, as you know, Chris Fair, Obama's getting beaten up by the neocons, the architects of these disasters, for not staying longer in Iraq. And they're citing the fact that the Iraqi army collapses because somehow we didn't stay there longer to train them, even though it was pretty clear that the Maliki government did not want the U.S. to stay, and the Iranians were pressuring them to kick the Americans out.
I just wish that someone would do their job in the media and say the reason why we left was not because, I'm sure Obama didn't want to stay, but Maliki, you know, he's the sovereign. He gets to say. And their disagreements with us over the status of forces were legitimate. They did not want security contractors like Blackwater operating outside of either the Uniform Code of Military Justice or Iraqi justice. Basically, all of these contractors that we were relying upon were able to break laws with complete impunity because they didn't fall under either punitive system. And they were doing things like using bullets that were in complete violation of international humanitarian law, for example, hollow head bullets, so that when they entered the body, people were dying from injuries that had it been a legal bullet would have been injured, but they would not have died. So the Iraqis objected. The State Department loves using those entities because they say they've never lost a principal, but not losing any principal came at a lot of loss of life to Iraqis. So I wish that someone would say, you know, actually they kind of kicked us out. And had we stayed, we didn't have any legal basis to stay without a status of forces agreement. And I just wish that someone had some institutional memory. And when Rumsfeld and his evil associates make these arguments, that they can actually make the counterpoint. It's appalling that people aren't reminding them of the facts.
Well, will the same thing happen with Afghanistan then? Will they be able to pull out this same chestnut?
Well, okay. So in some sense, in Afghanistan, the Status of Forces Agreement is a little bit of political drama. We already have a bilateral instrument that allows us to stay. The reason why Obama wants the Status of Forces Agreement is that our bilateral agreement allows Americans to stay. The Status of Forces Agreement would allow us to remain, at least with a patina of NATO involvement. This is almost preposterous because Afghans aren't fooled. Right now, NATO is mostly American. But for whatever political reason, you know, Obama wants us to be a status of forces agreement and essentially a renegotiation of what we do, where we do it, how we do it, in what capacity. And we can debate whether or not, you know, that made sense. But it's not, strictly speaking, comparable to the Iraq situation where we didn't have a bilateral agreement where we could stay and we needed to have that sofa to continue staying.
Well, just in closing, Christine Fair, of course, the four NATO soldiers killed today were Czech soldiers. But I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is in India. She's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who was a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasic Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about why the tech giants Google, Amazon, Facebook, Netflix, Yahoo, and Microsoft have backed away from supporting net neutrality.
رنگ گل اناری لطف نصیب ما کو رنگی نظاری زاری ہے رنگی نظاری زاری موسیقی
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julie Samuels, who's the Executive Director of Engine Advocacy, a public interest group that supports the growth of technology entrepreneurship through economic research, policy analysis, and advocacy on local and national issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julie Samuels.
Thank you for having me.
And there's a growing concern and an awareness that Google is absent now from the net neutrality fight, one that they led only 4 years ago. And you're quoted as saying that now that this is an incredibly important moment for startups and mid-sized tech companies because it's primarily their battle. But then you say that in terms of the Googles and the Amazons, et cetera, they can afford bad net neutrality. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is, listen, what we're talking about when we talk about net neutrality, and one of the things that we're so concerned about is essentially pay-to-play internet, right? Paid prioritization, where big companies or companies who are well-funded can afford to get faster access to get their content to customers. And the truth of the matter is companies like Google and Amazon are, you know, needless to say, very well-funded. They can afford to live in a world where that those are the rules. And that's, by the way, not to say that they're wrong. It's to say that every company needs to make to pick kind of the policy issues that most affect them. And clearly what's going on here is that this isn't the top of the list for companies like Google and Amazon. And I think, again, to repeat what I already said, it's largely because they can afford it.
Well, as we speak, though, the FCC is being blitzed with complaints, 625,000 so far. I believe the complaint line closes on July the 15th. And almost all of them, from what I understand, are against the idea of paid prioritization. So where would you say the fight is going with or without Google?
So I think that, listen, I'm working really hard with a bunch of startups and on behalf of my organization also to get to a world without paid prioritization. And I think the fight's going really well. Listen, it's fundamentally important that we have real net neutrality, that everyone has equal access and ability to get on the internet. That's crucial. So I think that's why we're seeing so many people filing comments at the FCC, and I think we'll continue to see that through the summer. The period actually, the initial period does end next week, but then there are another 2 months in which you can file responses. So we'll actually, there are more opportunities over the course of the summer. And I think that the reason that so many people are filing comments, the reason that so many small startups and mid-sized startups are getting involved is because they understand that this fundamentally matters. And that's, frankly, really encouraging.
Well, apparently one of the things that stimulated a lot of people to contact the FCC was John Oliver's new show on HBO, where he compared the new head of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, to a dingo, saying that Wheeler, who's a former top cable lobbyist and now FCC chairman, was, quoting John Oliver, the equivalent of needing a babysitter and hiring a dingo.
John Oliver is much funnier than I am. Let's start with that. And, you know, I would actually say to your listeners, if you haven't seen it, you should go and watch it, not just because it's funny, but because John Oliver makes some really important points and gets them across in a way that not many of us can. So I do think that's right. And listen, I think when you take a step back, there are certain moments, there are certain issues of internet freedom, of internet governance, and of the way that we all use the internet that really resonate with people. And this is one of those. And that's why, you know, John Oliver spent 13 minutes of his show talking about net neutrality. That's why so many hundreds of startups and individuals have filed comments at the FCC, because people who spend their time on the internet, and we all do today, you know, for better or worse, that's the world we live in, really fundamentally understand why this is so important.
Again, I'm speaking with Julie Samuels, who's the Executive Director of Engine Advocacy, a public interest group that supports the growth of technology entrepreneurship through economic research, policy analysis, and advocacy on local and national issues. So tell me about this group that these big internet giants belong to. It's a Washington-based group called the Internet Association with Google. I think they founded it along with Facebook, eBay, Amazon, and Yahoo. these are the people that seem to be getting, you know, wobbly on this fight, if not abandoning the battlefield. So what is this organization all about?
So we do a lot of work with the Internet Association. They've been meaningful, powerful allies on a lot of issues. But again, they're kind of, their company base is slightly different than, or their member base, I should say, is slightly different from ours. Lots of their members, like the ones you just listed, for instance, are very big companies. And so the set of issues that affect their business are oftentimes different than the set of issues that affect the startup's business. And at Engine, we represent, you know, those small startups. But listen, I don't want to let Google and the Amazons of the world off the hook for not being more involved. You know, I said earlier that part of what's going on here is this issue might not be as pressing for them because they can afford it. And what we're talking about here, which I should be more clear about, is not that Google and Facebook and Amazon have access to the Internet, but the next Google, the next Facebook, the next Amazon have the same access so that they too can start a company that can grow into being the next big company. That's really what this is all about. But I do think that companies, like those big companies, have a responsibility to pay it forward, if you will. And in the past, they've been big fighters for these really important principles. And I hope that they will be good citizens and continue to fight for these again, very important principles.
Well, but Google spent $15.8 million last year lobbying lawmakers, making it the 12th biggest spender on Capitol Hill, spending slightly less than AT&T. So if they're not in the net neutrality fight, what are they spending that lobbying money on?
Good question. I don't know. I don't know if I'm the one who's most qualified to answer that. You know, I'm not in their books. But Google, listen, they've spent a lot of time lately. They've been a little bit more vocal in some of the NSA issues. This year, they did a lot of really important work on patent reform, and that was appreciated. But again, I mean, listen, Google's a big company. Its interests are of big company interests now, for better or worse. So I think that's what we're seeing. And I think that transition's been difficult in a lot of ways, but I think that a lot of small companies who grow to the size Google's grown to as rapidly as Google has, they kind of deal with that a bit. And I don't know, we hope that Google will remember its roots and fight for important issues like an open Internet. And I think they will. I have to remain optimistic that they will. I think I'll chalk this up to some growing pains.
Well, what about this internet campaign, Google Don't Be Evil petition, that's aimed at the company's co-founders? It's gathered more than 335,000 signatures. Do you think that's getting their attention?
I can't imagine that it's not getting their attention. I just can't imagine. And I have to imagine that a lot of those 300,000 plus signatures are probably from Google engineers, right? It's a really large number.
Well, tell me then.
It'll be interesting to see how they react.
Well, what happened, though, when Wheeler came to San Francisco and Silicon Valley recently to meet with a lot of the internet heads? Apparently, the big guys showed up, and a lot of the people who are most affected by this net neutrality ruling that's now in flux, if you will, some of them didn't show up. So what happened there, like Dropbox and people like that? So do you have any understanding of why that didn't happen?
So there were a series of meetings, is my understanding, while he was out here. And one of those meetings did involve a lot of mid and small-sized startups. We actually had a representative from Engine there as well. And those people showed up to tell the chairman why net neutrality matters. And I believe that the chairman, while he was here, also got to meet with the mayor. San Francisco's mayor, Ed Lee, has been a leader on this issue as well lately, which has been encouraging. And he did meet with a bunch of company representatives. But listen, I think part of what's so important about this whole thing and part of what I find so compelling from a process point of view is like that quote you read of mine at the beginning, this idea that this is a moment for the smaller companies and the mid-sized companies to really stand up in a policy debate, because they're going to have to do that. I think, and maybe this sounds a little Pollyanna-ish, but I do think this is really important. For a long time, a lot of the smaller companies kind of relied on the larger companies to carry their water in the policy debate. to go to D.C., to put in all the money to make the arguments. But sometimes the big companies and the smaller companies, their interests are going, maybe not diverged, I don't even know if it's that strongly, but they might not have the same interests. So this is a really important moment for these smaller companies to realize that if you want to make something happen in policy in D.C., then you've got to make it happen. And I think that we are seeing that, and those companies did come out to meet with the chairman, and that's been really encouraging from my point of view.
But the cable companies, and this is what the issue is here, whether or not the internet's going to be cableized, and anybody that has pays money to either Comcast or Time Warner, who are trying to merge, or Verizon or AT&T, knows it's the poverty of choice. The internet speed is in America has gone down. You get four times, or maybe 10 times the speed for a quarter of the price in France. And you mentioned the mayor of San Francisco. Just the other day, I was speaking with the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, about another matter that the mayor's conference discussed, the idea of bringing back post office banks for the underserved rural communities. And then we somehow high-speed broadband came up, and boy, did he go on a tear about how these big companies like Verizon preemptively sue states and municipalities, preventing them from putting in the kind of broadband service that the city of Chattanooga offers, for example, which is, I think, the fastest broadband in the country.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's even worse than just suing. What a lot of those cable companies do, they've lobbied at the state level to get laws on the books in the states that don't allow municipalities to provide their own broadband, their own internet access, which I think is totally disgusting.
I know, but my question to you is, since you're lobbying for the startups and the people that are going to be most affected if net neutrality goes away and they adopt this payola system, is there any proactive political activities going on? I don't mean to do nasty, unpleasant things like what Comcast and company are doing, but on the other hand, what's happening?
So the first thing we're doing is working on that primary fight to make net neutrality not go away. But you hit on something that's really important, and it's that the cable companies are incredibly well-funded. They outspend kind of the community fighting for net neutrality and lobbying dollars at least 3-1. And they're in D.C. and they're on the Hill every day. So it makes our lift a little bit heavier, if you will. But that's fight number one, right? That's what we're dealing with right now. But I think, you know, what you talk about is another really important angle to this, and it's working with cities, with municipalities to get more internet access, to get more internet access to rural communities, to cities, to places where, you know, our internet is really slow and really expensive, particularly when compared with the rest of the world. I don't think people really realize that that's the case. It's frankly quite depressing. For instance, here in San Francisco, we have under the city downtown all this what's called dark fiber. About 10, 15 years ago, a bunch of buildings, it was during the last bubble bursting, a bunch of new buildings had been built downtown, and as part of the deal to build downtown, they had all laid fiber right under the city. And then when they went bankrupt, the city took over the building. The city now owns that fiber, and it's just sitting there not used. And that is, you know, fast internet access that the cable companies don't own, but it's sitting dark fiber under the city. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to start working more and more on to fix that problem.
So who's keeping the fiber dark? I mean, what's stopping San Francisco from doing what Chattanooga does?
So, you know, I ask the same question all the time. and I think, you know, the answers are all over the place. Some of it has to do with logistics. Some of it has to do with bureaucracy. In some instances, it has to do with the cable companies who've lobbied to keep that status quo. And I think all of those are terrible excuses. And I hope that as part of this larger national conversation we're having about net neutrality, we're going to get more people interested in those issues too, so we can help move the ball to get more internet. And it's not just to the startups. This is to every American, right? To get internet access to every American.
So do you think that the fact that Google, who led the fight to maintain net neutrality back in 2006 and now appear to be backing away from the fight, or at least they've gone silent, would this have anything to do with the growth of Google Fiber, which is their high-speed broadband that they're laying around the country already in Portland, San Jose, Salt Lake City, Provo, Phoenix, San Antonio, Austin, Kansas City, Nashville, Atlanta, Charlotte, and Raleigh-Durham?
I think that, listen, I think there are a couple different ways you can answer that question. One of the ways I like to think about it is if Google's a company that's got a bunch of resources to put toward internet access, right now they're putting them toward fiber. And that's good because, you know, that what that does is create competition for internet access. Because really, at the end of the day, the problem is there's no competition, right? I mean, how many options do you have for internet in your house? Maybe two?
Right. Well, it's that's what the cableization of the internet means, right? It's just like these people that bring you the television channels, the poverty of choice, where you spend all your time channel surfing and there's nothing to watch.
Right. Right. So, you know, I'm very much in favor of Google's efforts to lay fiber and to create a viable alternative for internet access. And I commend them for that. And, you know, of course, I wish they'd be more present, more out front in the fight we're having at the FCC right now about net neutrality. But their efforts to lay fiber are much appreciated, too.
Well, just in closing, then, Julie Samuels, what can you tell our listeners to do to help you and all of the mid-size internet companies and all of the startups to maintain net neutrality, which is the reason why these huge companies that have abandoned the fight became the huge companies that they are?
Right. Okay, I've got a couple things. The first thing is if you are involved with a small company, with a startup, or know someone who is, you can go to a website we have called startupsfornetneutrality.org and sign up there, and we'll keep you in the loop. We've got people who are available to help folks file comments at the FCC explaining why this matters. We're trying to get as many voices heard there as possible. So you can either, like I said, Startups for Net Neutrality or our website, engine.is. We want to help people make those voices heard. If there are consumers out there who want to do the same, there's a website called dearfcc.org. That's dearfcc.org. And from that site, consumers can file their own comments at the FCC and tell the FCC why they care about strong net neutrality, why they care about the promise of an open internet. Because here's the thing, like I said before, the cable industry outlobbies us at least at a 3-to-1 level. And unless we get people's voices heard, real Americans, real American citizens, real American businesses, everyday people, there's no way we're going to see change. But I strongly believe that if we do get those people involved, then the FCC can and will do the right thing.
Well, Julie Samuels, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Julie Samuels, who's the Executive Director of Engine Advocacy, a public interest group that supports the growth of technology entrepreneurship through economic research, policy analysis, and advocacy on local and national issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.